Henning found himself a chair and sat down. There was coffee and water, cups and glasses on the table. The newspapers that usually spilled over the table had been removed. Everyone sat with lowered eyes. Several were crying openly. Henning found it hard to believe how much warmth and peace he felt simply from being with them. And he thought to himself how lucky he was to work with such a great team. That it was good to have someone to sit with, in silence. Later that evening, Henning sat down at his own desk, beside Ivor's, and stared at the candle that was still burning. Until very recently, he hadn't been able to cope with flames, but now he watched the orangey-yellow flickering light until everything else fell out of focus. He closed his eyes and pondered what Ivor must have discovered, something that was so important he had to die. Henning took his PC out of his bag and checked the 123 News front page. The first 8 posts were about Ivor's murder, most of them taken from the Norwegian news agency. One of the posts had a black frame round it. The headlines included, "Killed in his own home." In the obituary, the editor-in-chief, Sture Skipsrud, spoke of Ivor's charisma, his warm character, the positive energy and fun that he brought with him wherever he went. The Henriette Hagerup case from earlier that year was cited as the highlight of his career. Several leading news celebrities had condemned the killing, and articles had been written about other journalists who had suffered a similar fate. The reports about the actual investigation didn't say much, and Henning understood why. For both technical and tactical reasons, the police were, as yet, sparing with any information. Henning checked his emails in case Ivor had sent him anything before he was killed. As expected, there were countless emails waiting for him, but nothing from Ivor. "You have to find out what he discovered," Henning told himself, "if it had anything to do with Rasmus Bjelland." But first, he looked up everything he could find out about Bodil Svenkerud's death. Trina's story had been at the back of his mind all day, behind the shock, behind the anger. The old lady had been knocked down and killed on Eckersberg's gate in Oslo's posh West End in January 1996, and the case had never been solved. However, it didn't take long for Henning to find something that confirmed his suspicions about Toru Pulli and Charlie Heisiter. The building where Mrs. Svenkerud lived had been acquired by Heisiter Property in autumn 1995 and then been sold on for a considerably higher sum to Pulli Property not long after Svenkerud's death. Henning had heard that the friends often agreed an under-the-table price for acquisitions and sales like this, but then registered another. The buyer, most frequently Pulli, also conned the banks into providing more capital than he strictly needed, and the extra money was used for other investments and to finance his increasingly extravagant lifestyle. Mrs. Svenkerud had got in their way. So they'd made sure the obstacle was removed. If that was the case, it would explain how Bjelland knew about the death. According to Ivor, Bjelland and Charlie stopped working together, certainly in Norway, in 1996. Henning logged into Firecracker 2, a chat program that his secret source in Oslo Police, 6 Tjermis 7, had designed especially for their highly confidential two-way communication. Henning didn't know the identity of his source, but after communicating back and forth for many years now, he'd concluded that he, or she, could hardly be much older than 40, primarily because of their computer skills, but also because of the words they used. It was the language of a young person. The fact that 6 Tjermis 7 had given him the handle Macca Packa also indicated that the source was familiar with recent children's TV shows. Henning had never looked into it any more than that. It was part of the unspoken pact. He would never ask who his source was, and they would never meet face to face. Sixtiermis 7 fed Henning with information from various investigations that he or she had access to, and Henning made sure he used the information judiciously. This teamwork had led to a good number of headlines over the years. However, it was a while since Henning had had any contact with his source, even though he'd tried regularly to get in touch. He decided to stay logged on to Firecracker 2 for the rest of the evening, if that's what it took. Almost everyone else had gone home, when finally there was a ding-dong from his computer, like someone ringing a bell. Henning closed all the other windows, keeping only Firecracker 2 open. Sixtiermis 7. I hoped you'd be in touch this evening. My condolences. Macapaka. Thanks. Long time no see. Sixtiermis 7. Been extremely busy recently. How's it going with you? Every time Sixtiermis 7 sent a new message, Henning's computer sang out ding-dong, so he turned the volume down. Macapaka. I'm working on a few things. Sixtiermis 7. That's not what I meant. Henning took a deep breath and looked over at Ivor's empty desk again. Macapaka. It's hard to take it in that he's dead, and hard to believe it's not my fault. Henning explained that Ivor had been helping him with a few things recently, and that he'd saved Henning's life when someone tried to knock him down on Seil's Duxgarten. Macapaka. They might have found out that Ivor was helping me, or at least suspected. Sixtiermis 7. Maybe, but you'll never know the answer. Best not to waste time and energy blaming yourself. Gunderson was an adult. He knew what he was doing. Macapaka. And he wasn't always careful. Just waded straight in. Was beaten up not long ago because he didn't go easy. A man came into the office. Henning guessed he was in charge of the night shift. Sixtiermis 7. If you're interested, I've got a couple of things from the investigation. Macapaka. Very. Sixtiermis 7. Gunderson's PC and mobile weren't found in the flat. Henning raised his eyebrows. Sixtiermis 7. Either the people who did it wanted to check them, mails, log files, folders, etc., or they wanted to delete the content. Probably both. But we're working against the clock here. Macapaka. How do you mean? Sixtiermis 7. Apple and Google aren't keen to give us access to people's private accounts, even when they're dead, so it might take a while. Henning swore under his breath. Sixtiermis 7. No doubt all the data will have been deleted by the time we get our hands on his computer. It's easy enough to remove documents from all the servers. Henning looked up and saw the night shift guy talking to the girl who was sitting at the news desk. They gave each other a hug. There was another muffled ping. Sixtiermis 7. But I heard that you've also got someone after you. Any idea who? Or why? Macapaka. Yes and no, but I'm pretty sure that the attempts on my life, Ivor's death, and maybe even Toropuli's death, have something to do with Rasmus Bjelland, and no one knows where he is. Either he's dead, or he's got another identity and is living somewhere else. Sixtiermis 7. That's certainly a possibility. Henning drank some water from the glass. Sixtiermis 7. So, what are you going to do now? You said you were working on something.
Macapaca.
I've got a meeting tomorrow that I hope might give some answers, and then I'd thought of going down to see William Hellberg in Turnsburg. He was the one who told me that Charlie Highseater and Tora Pulley had fallen out. He might know more. Maybe even something that might lead to Bjelland.
Sixth term is 7.
I'll try to log on tomorrow evening as well, around the same time. Might have more to tell about the investigation by then.
Macapaca.
Thanks.
Sixth term is 7.
Okay. Going to log out now. Stay healthy.
Macapaca.
You too. Chapter 19.
Hey!
A voice rang out over the general noise in the shop. Just keep looking straight ahead, Roger Blystad thought. He's not shouting at you, not at Bunpris on a Sunday evening. He carried on looking for the coffee he needed for the morning. Couldn't start the day without coffee.
Fancy meeting you here!
The voice had come closer. Blystad turned his head a fraction, saw some feet, very definitely, coming towards him.
Shit. I'd recognize that face anywhere!
What the fuck was he going to say? What the hell was he going to do?
It's been a long time!
Blystad lifted his chin and turned round to face the smiling man who had stopped half a meter in front of him. It was Alfred. Or the Shower, as they'd called him in high school, because he always stood right in front of you when he was talking to you, so it was impossible to avoid the spray of his spit. What the hell was he doing in Brandbu?
Jeez, man! How's it going?
Alfred held out his hand.
Hello, Alfred, Blystad said. All right, thanks.
They shook hands. Alfred had close-set eyes, a round, boyish face, and messy hair that stood out in all directions. It must be at least 20 years since they'd last seen each other at school, and the main difference was that he'd put on about 13 kilos in the meantime.
What are you, doing here?
Blystad asked, even though the answer seemed obvious. Alfred was wearing an Oslo taxi uniform.
Got a long fare from Oslo, he said. Just popped in to get something to eat before heading back. And you? Do you live out this way, then?
He'd thought a lot about what he should say if he bumped into anyone from the past. And the answer he had come up with was, as little as possible. He'd say that he didn't have much time and had to be going. But if Alfred was anything like he had been back then, that would just make things worse. Not only did he stand right up in your face when he spoke to you, he talked incessantly and fired constant questions. A real gossip monger.
And Brandbu, eh? Wife and kids, the works, eh?
Blystad pictured the photographs of the car his wife had been sitting in. What was left of it. What was left of her. He blinked furiously a few times.
No, just me, he replied.
Oh, what are you up to then?
Well, between jobs, you might say.
Alfred nudged him hard on the shoulder.
Have to say, you're in good shape. You were always a little podgy at school, I remember. But you're looking bloody fit now.
Yes, I, work out.
And it was true. He didn't know how many miles he had done on the treadmill in the basement.
Great to see you again, Alfred said.
Blystad had to stop himself from wiping off the shower of spittle that landed on his cheek.
Have you signed up for the reunion, eh?
Blystad looked into his round face.
reunion?
Yeah, think an invitation was sent to everyone. Don't have anything to do with the organization, but it's next month. Or the one after, can't remember. Oh, would be great, man, if you came. Oh, fucking hell. 20 years!
Bleistad tried to smile, but realized he was failing.
Seriously, did you not get an email? Eh?
Bleistad wasn't sure what to answer. A woman went past with two bags of nappies in her hands. He followed her with his eyes, felt hot and bothered.
There's a Facebook group for people who went to our school,
Alfred prattled on.
Are you on Facebook, eh?
Bleistad shook his head. Alfred snapped his fingers.
Hell you what! Give me your address and I'll make sure you get an invite.
Bleistad didn't answer. It was hard to breathe. I'm a bit busy, actually, he said abruptly. It's getting late. I have to get home. He stepped back, then stood and took a measure of Alfred. Alfred stepped forward and nudged him again, this time in the side.
Well, good to see you again anyway.
Bleistad smiled briefly. He wasn't sure if Alfred could tell how desperate he was to get away as quickly as possible.
See you again.
He lifted a hand, then turned and walked away, picking up speed. He felt Alfred's eyes on his neck like two laser beams. When Bleistad turned into the next aisle, he stopped, leaned against the shelves, and squeezed his eyes shut. What the fuck was he going to do? Should he ask Alfred to keep quiet and not say that they'd met? He might not mention it to anyone. Why would he? But then there was the fucking reunion. Hundreds of old pupils would be there, all reminiscing, and then that old gossip, the shower, would say,
"Guess who I met at Brandbu?"
Bleistad knew what it meant. He had to move. Again. He always had a rucksack ready in the bedroom at home, packed with everything he needed. Money, passport, clothes, light and practical tools, dehydrated food that didn't take much space, water, a basic first aid kit. He got the rucksack out of the cupboard, checked that everything was there and nothing was out of date. It was all good. Damn Alfred, he thought. Damn Facebook and damn the fucking reunion. He didn't want to move, not again. He'd kind of settled in Brandbu, even though his life was monotonous and boring. He didn't do much more than sleep, watch TV, play on the computer and go to the shop. And work out, of course. He occasionally took on a job or two, but only for something to do and to earn a bit of extra money. But more often than not, he said no, as there was always a microscopic chance that he might bump into someone he knew. Norway was far too small. He should have gone to the USA and disappeared in some enormous city. But then he'd have to start all over again in a new country. At least here at home he knew how things worked, the social code, the culture. And he'd always liked Norway, Norwegian milk, the newspapers and TV programs. And he wanted to be near his mum, as she was alone with the cat and all those demanding patients at the Major Stuer Clinic in Oslo. Bleistad went down into the basement and started the treadmill. Ran for 3/4 of an hour, even though it was late, while he listened to AC/DC and thought about what he should do. By the time he stopped, he'd decided to wait and see and keep an eye on the situation. He didn't need to move immediately. After all, it was some time until the reunion. It wasn't likely that Alfred would meet anyone and tell them before then. So he took a long shower, made up some sandwiches, then sat down at the kitchen table and opened his PC. It had become a habit, since Tore Pulli was killed, to check the news in the online papers before he went to bed.
He always started with VG, and the first headline he saw was that a journalist had been killed in his own home. Blystad clicked on the report and took a bite of his sandwich. He stopped chewing as soon as he saw a photograph of the dead journalist further down. But it was Ivar Gundersen. Blystad didn't register his own gasp. Nothing was said about how Gundersen had been killed, but Blystad opened his email straight away. He hadn't used his computer since the morning. He'd been playing Call of Duty all day. He checked to see if he'd received any new emails. He hadn't. All the same, Gundersen was dead. Him too. Blystad sat back and thought about what it might mean, and whether he should say anything to the police. But then again, what would he say? Gundersen had been given strict instructions to delete any correspondence between them, not to print anything out, and to make sure that the emails were wiped from any servers and hard disks. Had he done that? Could he be sure that Gundersen had done that? Blystad went to all the online newspapers he knew to see if there were any more details. The police were still examining Gundersen's flat for clues. They hadn't finished questioning the neighbors and potential witnesses, and there would be a press conference the following morning. But for the moment, there was nothing more to be found. Blystad thought about his wife, the escape he'd planned for her, that she never had the chance to try. He'd told her to trust him, and that had killed her. Henning Juhl had also taken him on his word. And look what happened to him. And now, Ivar Gundersen. Blystad took a deep breath, then released it through his mouth. What the fuck was he going to do? Chapter 20. Isabel was wearing nothing more than the tiniest of bikini briefs and a scarf that she would pull round her neck, torso, and over her nipples. Sometimes she pulled it back and forth between her legs as well, to whoops and wolf whistles from the audience. Her dark curls were sleek, as though she'd taken a dip and then laid in the sun for 10 minutes. She really was a talent, Charlie Heisey thought. She had the audience in the palm of her hand with her seductive eyes and sensual moves. She was elegant and sexy and used the whole stage. She wrapped herself round the pole with ease and grace, showing off the muscles in her stomach and arms, made it look effortless. The pumping rhythms reminded Charlie of Oslo, of Odeon, and Torin. In the past few weeks, Charlie had been trying to remember when they first met, how they'd become friends. But he couldn't. He couldn't remember the sequence in which things had happened. He just knew that his entire childhood and youth, his life here today, was pervaded by Tore. Perhaps the strongest memory he had of Tore was the evening that Tore's parents were killed in a car crash, and he'd knocked on Charlie's window late that night. They'd sat in his room all night, talking and listening to music. Tore had wept on and off, the first and only time Charlie had seen him cry. Perhaps that's why this memory had stuck for so long, because he was the one Tore had come to, not William, nor any of their other friends. He and Tore were most alike. The two of them understood each other. For a few moments, Charlie had forgotten the show and music, but then suddenly he felt the scarf round his neck. Above him, Isabel got closer, bent down towards him, pulled the scarf to the left and right until his neck burned, then drew his face in towards her and kissed him on the cheek. Charlie knew that the audience at Senzuela, which was 95% men, was jealous of him. He finished his drink, turned round to look at the audience with a cat-that-got-the-cream expression on his face, which produced a few cheers. She took the scarf back onto the stage and finished the dance, but didn't get many tips. The men were too scared to give her much when Charlie was there. So he took out 200 riyals and tucked it in her bikini. But when she was about to thank him with another kiss on the cheek, he stopped her, held her firmly by the neck, under all her curls.
"Never do that again," he said brutally.
Then he let her go and went to the back of the club where Freddy was waiting for him, standing tall and broad.
"Did everything go well at the airport?"
Charlie asked over his shoulder as he moved towards the exit.
"Yep,"
Freddy replied.
"The plane was delayed, but everything went fine at customs."
"How much did he have with him?"
"Just over 20,000 euros.
A quarter of an apartment, Charlie mused. That wasn't much. A good thing the deliveries were frequent.
"Has Daddy Longlegs called?"
"No," Freddy said. Charlie swore to himself. He'd read what had happened in Norway, but the details in the online papers were scant. As soon as they were out on the street, Charlie lit a cigarette. A car sailed by close to the pavement in front of him. It made him look up and over to the other side of the street. A black Audi had stopped there, motor running. There were two men in the car. Charlie nodded to Freddy, who immediately knew what he was thinking. Freddy dodged the passing cars and crossed over to the other side of the road, putting a hand to his inner pocket as he approached. As he was about to rap on the car window, the Audi sped off, tires screeching. Freddy was left standing in a cloud of exhaust, and the car was gone. Moments later, Freddy was back with Charlie.
"I got the registration number."
Charlie took a draw on his cigarette as he looked to see if the car was coming back.
"Do you think that's the one that's been outside your building recently?"
"Don't know,"
he said.
"Looked the same. Same color and model."
He didn't like it, that was for sure. God knows he had plenty of potential enemies in the area. And knowing what was going on at home in Norway at the moment, who knows what might happen.
"I'll find out who they are," Freddy said.
Charlie continued to stare down the road. The car was nowhere to be seen.
"There's a party at Hassan's in B Block later," Freddy said. "Do you want to check it out?"
Charlie shook his head.
"Going in again?"
Freddy nodded towards the strip club.
"No,"
Charlie said, and threw the cigarette butt down on the ground, but didn't step on it.
"Take me home. I've had enough of whores for one night."
Chapter 21. Henning thought about Ivar. The fact that they'd left him to hang there and bleed to death. It bore all the hallmarks of torture. Someone had tried to get information out of him. His flat had been ransacked, which also indicated that whoever was responsible had been looking for physical evidence as well. Notes, printouts. Presumably that was why they'd taken Ivar's mobile phone and computer. Henning thought about what he'd asked Ivar to do no more than a week ago. To try and find out more about Rasmus Bjelland, in particular about his relationship with Tor Pulli and Charlie Heisiter. Henning had done some research on Bjelland himself in advance of interviewing him in 2007 and remembered that carpenter Bjelland and his Brazilian wife had fled Norway and started out for themselves in the property development business down there in Natal, Brazil, with Bjelland working as Charlie's carpenter. But then, one of Bjelland's business associates had been shot when he went to look at a potential site, and even though the man still had cash on him when he was found, the local police had concluded that he'd been the victim of a robbery. Brazil was a country of corruption and crime, and it wasn't entirely unthinkable that someone in the business didn't like the fact that Bjelland and his wife had also set up store, especially as Bjelland had been accused of supplying the police with information
as part of their 2007 Norwegian-Brazilian operation. It was widely rumored that what Bjellin told the police had led to a lot of people being arrested, charged, and then sentenced. His wife might be of interest. Mariana. Wasn't that her name? Bjellin hadn't told him much about her, except that he'd had to leave her, or rather, send her away to a secret address. Presumably that meant she would be just as hard to find as Bjellin himself, but Henning decided to give it a try all the same. He opened a new window and typed Mariana plus Bjellin plus Natal. Got hits for a hotel in Hordaland, an Italian language school, and a horoscope for celebrities who had Saturn in Aquarius. He found some Brazilian sites as well, but nothing that was relevant. Google asked if he meant Marianne. He tried just Mariana plus Natal. Found the Facebook profile of a woman called Mariana Natal, photographs of what looked like a town getting ready for fiesta, a website that claimed to give the precise distance from KwaZulu-Natal to Ilha Mariana. Henning sighed. His thoughts went back to Charlie Highseater and the fact that Bjellin had worked for him. He did a search for Highseater as well, used his proper name, Charles, and then typed in Natal and Mariana. The first hit made him sit up and move closer to the screen. It was an article from a local paper in the Natal region. Henning couldn't understand the text, but judging from the pictures, it was about the development of a new residential complex. Charlie was standing smiling in front of a digger. There were several other people around him, including a Mariana de la Rosa. She was standing in the background with a file in her hand and a hard plastic helmet on her head. If she didn't actually work for Charlie, she certainly knew him. This was the woman Bjellin had married, Henning reasoned, and then Googled her name. Found a woman with exactly the same name who had a Twitter account. She was also on Facebook, but she was from Monterey. It was, Henning discovered, a very common name. And he started to lose hope. If Mariana de la Rosa didn't want to be found, or if Rasmus Bjellin had hidden her away, she would probably keep a low profile, just like her husband. Henning worked his way through the first 30 hits, but found no one with any likeness to the woman who was photographed with Charlie. Not until he clicked onto a news website and saw a report about a woman who had died in a car explosion not far from Alto de Rodriguez on the 16th of June 2007. The woman was called Mariana de la Rosa, and there was a small square photograph of her further down the page. It was her. So, Mariana de la Rosa was dead. Henning Google translated the article. And even though a lot of the text made no sense in Norwegian, there was little doubt about the essence of the story. Mariana's car had blown up because someone had wanted it to. The police went as far as to say the explosion was caused by a bomb. Henning remembered the sadness in Bjellin's eyes when he spoke about her. Henning had originally thought it was because he missed her, because she was on the other side of the world. And it would be a long time before they saw each other again. But now, he understood. Mariana de la Rosa was killed not long before Bjellin left Brazil himself. A threat to Bjellin could equally be a threat to his wife, or both of them. And the fact that they'd taken her out had given him the incentive to flee. Henning realized his thoughts were running wild. So he sat back and tried to get them into some kind of order. He thought about what Bjellin's motive for telling him about Tor Pooley's involvement in the 90s murder might be and wondered if perhaps he had now found it. What if it was Tora's fault that Mariana was killed? What if Tora had spread the rumor that Bjellin was an informer?
Then we're talking about a serious motive, Henning thought enthusiastically. And somebody had clearly given the police valuable information prior to their massive operation in May 2007, which had resulted in so many people being arrested. But it wasn't Bjelland. Henning believed him. What if it had been Tore? What if he'd tried to lay the blame on Bjelland afterwards? Henning checked the time. It was late, but if he knew Veronica Nansen, she would still be up. He decided to ring her.
"Hi,"
she said when she answered the phone, clearing her throat at the same time. Henning heard her sit up on the white leather sofa.
"I'm so glad you called," she said. "I've been worried about you. I heard what happened to your colleague. I'm so sorry."
"Thank you," Henning said.
"How are you?"
she asked before he could start on his questions. He straightened his shoulders. "I'm fine," he said. "There's something I want to talk to you about. Is this a good time? Had you gone to bed?"
No, I was just sitting here watching a bad film. What is it? Do you need somewhere to stay?"
No, Henning wondered how best to say it. "I found something," he said, and spent the next few minutes telling her about Rasmus Bjelland's wife. He then shared his most recent theories and ideas with Veronica. The fact that Tore might have started a false rumor about someone, and that his rumor might have led to a woman being killed, didn't seem to make her angry or sad. Perhaps she'd just learned to accept that Tore had a criminal past and was still a criminal when they married, Henning thought.
"But he must have had his reasons for doing it," Henning said, "which could indicate that he had a more active role in Natal than we've previously thought, and that he was still working with Charlie in some way or another."
That wasn't hard for Henning to imagine. Tore had lied to Veronica before, and it was perfectly feasible that the two former best friends still had a kind of criminal partnership. He shared his line of thought with her.
"Tore might have given the police information," he carried on, "so that Charlie's competitors, of which there were quite a few by then, would get into trouble or disappear altogether."
It made sense, especially as Tore had struggled with debt for a few years, and who was best placed to take the blame afterwards? Rasmus Bjelland. A man who had branched out on his own and was not affected by the police operation in 2007. A man who knew a lot about Charlie's business, and therefore possibly also Tore's, after working with him in Brazil for years. He was a danger to them.
"Charlie's offices were also searched by the police," Henning told her. "But that might just have been a scam. Charlie had been in Natal for years, and he may well have strategically popped a few thousand real notes in important police pockets. Anyway, he was never charged with anything."
"But it sounds a bit foolhardy all the same," Veronica said.
"What?"
"Putting the blame on Bjelland. It could have backfired."
"Exactly. And that's what Charlie's so scared of now. He doesn't want the truth to come out about the scam in Brazil, because then a lot of people would come after him. Thugs who got arrested in 2007.
And yet..."
It was obvious she was thinking about something.
"What?"
Henning kept an eye on the night manager, who didn't seem to be paying any attention to the conversation.
"And yet, it would be pretty smart, too, if you think about it. Charlie had a clear playing field again in Natal as a result. If Bjelland was killed as well, as was obviously the plan, then all their problems would be solved. The scapegoat, the man they'd said had informed on those involved in the scam, would be gone."
Henning nodded. It was a fair point.
"The question is, how to prove it?" she said.
"Yes," Henning replied. "Charlie would never admit anything, and no one knows where Bjelland is."
But, Henning thought,
Ivor must have found something. The people who'd killed him were looking for something and had taken something with them, not just his mobile and PC. It had to be something concrete that he could find too. There was a short pause, but it wasn't awkward or embarrassing. Henning liked talking to Veronica. Her voice and the silences they allowed to grow between them had a calming effect on him. If it really was a matter of revenge on Bjelland's part, she said, why didn't he just tell you that? Why didn't he say, it wasn't me who was the informer, it was Tor? Maybe he didn't have enough hard evidence, Henning suggested. But if he knew and was 100% certain that Tora had been involved in the murder of Bodil Svenkerud in 1996, then he might at least try to get him done for that. Perhaps not blood revenge, but a kind of justice all the same. If only I managed to do my part. Henning could tell she was thinking about his answer. At the same time, it was strange, Henning thought, that Tora and Charlie should go to such drastic measures to make him stop digging into an old murder case when, at the time, he didn't even know it was a murder case, let alone who the victim was. All he'd known at that time was that Bjelland wanted him to dig about to find out more. Even though he did suffer from memory loss from his fall from the second-floor balcony on the evening that Jonas died, it seemed unlikely that he'd come across any sensitive information about Tor or Charlie so soon after the interview with Bjelland. Poking around in old property sales and acquisitions took forever, and he would have to have worked on other things at 123 News as well. At the point, he'd still been a long way from putting two and two together. So, the measures Tore and Charlie took before the 11th of September 2007 must have been about something other than the murder of Bodil Svenkerud. Henning stood up. Of course! If Tore and Charlie had arranged for all the competition in Natal to disappear, if they had been informers and then laid the blame on Bjelland, if the truth were ever to get out, who would be the target of any revenge? The thoughts were coming fast and hard and got him so worked up that he started to pace back and forth. He told Veronica what he was thinking. This isn't about an old murder case, he said. Certainly not in the first instance. It's about now, about the fear of revenge from some of the hardcore gangs that were targeted in the 2007 police operation. It was a case of firefighting. Tora and Charlie were scared of getting caught out, Henning thought. They were afraid that Bjelland had put two and two together and that he'd told Henning about his suspicions. So they got nervous when Henning started to ask questions, which was why Tore had been keeping an eye on him, and why Charlie took a more physical approach. The fire. And who was left, now that Tore was dead? Henning had long suspected Charlie, but for the wrong reasons. This made sense. Charlie was still in Brazil, and he was trying to make all his problems vanish. In the course of the 15 years that he'd been there, he'd worked on one residential development after another. He'd managed projects worth hundreds of millions, so Henning had no reason to doubt Charlie's financial clout. He could easily have paid for people to fix things for him in Norway, cover up what needed covering, stop Henning's investigations. After all the arrests, he was as good as alone in Natal, and business appeared to be booming. But there's a lot of people who might feel the need for revenge if the truth got out, Henning said. And that's why Charlie was so keen to hide it, which must also be why Ivor was killed. It was all theory and speculation. He somehow had to verify or disqualify it all, and the only way to do that was to find Bjelland, if he was still alive. I think it sounds like you're onto something, Veronica said.
So do I,
was Henning's response. Just be careful, whatever you do.
Henning smiled. I'll do my best.
They finished the conversation, and he turned back to Ivor's desk. The police would definitely have gone through the call log on his mobile phone, but Ivor wasn't exactly known for making phone calls. He preferred to talk to people face to face, and to ask them things they didn't expect, to catch them unawares. He must have spoken to someone who knew what he was onto. Maybe he'd even uncovered it all. I have to get hold of Nora, Henning thought, whether she likes it or not. Ivor might have told her, or she might know something without realizing its relevance. But it was late. It could wait until morning to call. The police would also want to talk to her, which made Henning think about the grilling he'd have to go through the next day as well. He had to delay it for as long as possible. Henning went back to his desk and sat down, thought about what he could do to expose Charlie, if his line of thought was right. It wasn't just a matter of going to Brazil, even though that might be necessary at some point. One step at a time, he told himself. The following morning, he was going to meet Andreas Kjær, and hopefully he would then know what kind of information had been removed from the indicia report about Tore the evening Jonas died. It might prove to be important. Henning looked over at the candle that was still burning down on the desk beside him. It reminded him that his time was steadily running out. Chapter 22. When he eventually got out of bed, far too early, Roger Blystad wasn't sure that he'd slept at all. But the light was forcing its way into the bedroom, and it sounded like a family of birds had built a nest right outside his window. He'd been lying there for a while, thinking about Ivar Gunderson, about what he should do. He'd come to the conclusion that the best thing would be to leave and start anew elsewhere, lie as low as possible. But it was quite an effort to move, and he couldn't face starting right away. And he should at least have a cup of coffee before making such momentous decisions. When he got out into the kitchen, he discovered that meeting Alfred had in fact made him forget why he'd gone to the shop in the first place. He had to have a cup of coffee. So he got dressed and looked out of the kitchen window. There was no one outside. He looked around again when he got out onto the front step before hurrying over to the car. Nothing out of the ordinary. The big building on the other side of the road, a former adult education college, was still empty, as was the house beside it, which was why he had chosen to live right here. Brandbu was the perfect place to lie low. It was somewhere you drove past, rather than visited, and it wasn't on one of the main roads. Blystad was renting the house, fully furnished, from an old man who couldn't look after it anymore, but who didn't want to sell it yet, as he still hoped that one of his children or grandchildren might want to live there. It was perfect for Blystad. The old man was still the registered owner, and his name didn't appear in any register, as the contract was only between the two of them. Blystad drove down to the shop, bought some coffee, and picked up that day's edition of Aftenposten. While he waited for the coffee to brew, he sat at the kitchen table reading the paper. As expected, the murder of Ivar Gunderson was given a lot of attention. He flicked quickly to page 3, but couldn't see anything there or on the next couple of pages that he hadn't read in the online papers the night before. When the coffee was ready, he poured himself a large cup. He then read the paper from cover to cover, largely because he wanted to think about something else and to put off, for as long as possible, all that he had to do if he was going to move. But a name in the obituaries made him freeze, the cup halfway to his mouth. Our beloved, wonderful sister, our dearest sister-in-law and aunt, Vanya Kvalheim, born 31st of December 1951, passed away suddenly today, Oslo, 9th of October 2009. You were deeply loved. Our loss will be great. Anne Marit, Helma, Brith, Lars, Bita, Olav, the rest of the family. The funeral will be held at Grorud Church, 16th of October. There will be no reception after the service. Bleistad sat there, staring at the words, the names. Put down his cup. No, he said to himself. This isn't happening. This isn't fucking happening. Not her. But there was no doubt that it was her. There they all were. Anne Marit, Lars, Helma, and Bita, Brith and Olav. What the hell had happened? He went to the 180.no directory inquiries website and typed in his uncle Lars's name. While he waited for an answer, he wondered briefly if he should perhaps not use his own phone. But then he looked at the notice again and told himself he didn't have time to go out and look for a phone box. It can't be true, he thought over and over again. That she's dead.
Hello? Lars speaking?
Bleistad hesitated before saying hello. It occurred to him that it was quite early in the morning. He couldn't say his name. His throat was dry. He tried again, but the same thing happened. Bleistad heard a sigh at the other end.
And now you call.
Bleistad still couldn't speak. He could only think of his mother. His dead mother, that he hadn't been there when it happened. The last time they'd emailed each other, she hadn't said anything about being ill. She'd just told him about the journalist who had wanted to get in touch and who had now been killed.
Yes, he finally managed to pull himself together. I just saw the notice about Mum in the paper.
It hurt even more to say it out loud. It took all he had to stop himself from crying.
How did she die?
He asked. Uncle Lars sighed.
We're not quite sure yet, he replied. But it seems most likely that it was a heart attack. She died very suddenly in the afternoon, just after she got home from work.
Bleistad swallowed a sob.
So there's nothing suspicious about it, he said, once he'd regained control of his voice. Suspicious? Why do you ask? Why on earth would there be? Oh, I don't know, Bleistad said. I just thought...
He couldn't finish the sentence.
Forget it, he said, and sniffed.
They sat there listening to each other breathing for a few moments.
Where are you? Uncle Lars asked. Will you be coming to the funeral?
He thought about it. He should. But he shook his head.
No, he said. I can't.
Uncle Lars snorted. Then he hung up. Bleistad sat with the receiver in his hand.
Heart attack. Died very suddenly in the afternoon, just after she got home from work.
His mother was only 57 years old. She had at least another 20 or 25 to go. That was certainly what he'd assumed. And he would definitely have sorted out his life by then. It had never occurred to him that she might die before. But now, she was gone. Bleistad put the phone back down on the kitchen table and buried his head in his hands. Chapter 23 Henning woke with a start and quickly sat up. It took a few moments before he realized that he was still in the 123 news office and that it was morning. A TV was on by the main desk, but only the night manager and Henning were there. He couldn't remember lying down, and it felt like he'd spent the night with his head in a vice.
He blinked hard in an attempt to shock-start his eyes and moved his head from side to side to stretch his neck. Looked over at Ivor's desk. The candle had burned right down. All that was left was an empty workplace. Henning looked around, spotted a box of candles on a table further in. He stood up, went to get another candle, which he then put in the candlestick and lit with his Zippo lighter. He stood there for a few minutes before going to the coffee machine and pressing a button. While he waited the 30 seconds or so that it took to get a cup of coffee, he glanced bleary-eyed over at the front desk, where the night manager looked just as beat as he did.
"Morning," Henning said, blowing on his coffee as he went back to his desk. "Has anything happened overnight?"
The man, Henning didn't know what he was called, looked up from the screen.
"The police have just announced that they're looking for two men who were seen in the area close to Ivor's flat yesterday morning," he said.
Henning immediately felt more awake.
"Have they given any descriptions?"
"Yes." The man clicked on the screen a few times before starting to read what was written there. The screen reflected like a shiny skin on his glasses.
"Both are around 1.7 meters tall. They were dressed in dark clothes and looked like they might be of Eastern European descent. One of them was wearing a hoodie. The police have asked that they contact them as soon as possible."
The man continued to read, but Henning's concentration drifted. He remembered what Durim Redzepi looked like, and the description fitted him to a T. It sounded reasonable enough that he'd had someone with him, as no one would have managed to hang Ivor from the hook and winch him up alone. Henning remembered the first attempt on his own life, when Ivor had managed to push him out of the path of the white car that was driving straight at him. There had been two people in the car then, too. Mapping Ivor's final movements had become a priority, Henning thought. He had to find out who Ivor had been in touch with. Henning thanked the manager for the update and wondered if he should go and get Ivor's car, if he could find it. There was a chance that the police had discovered that Ivor had a car and perhaps already managed to locate it and bring it in for examination. The clock on the wall showed that it was just before 7. According to Pia Nurkelby, Andreas Kjær was going to be out running around 10. That meant that Henning would have to leave soon, before the office started to fill up. He didn't feel like chatting to anyone, and anyway, he wanted to get to Ivor's car before the police found it and towed it away. He finished his coffee, went out onto the street, where he hailed a cab and gave Gurbitz Gate 3 as the address. The police cordons had been removed, but there was still a police car outside Ivor's block. Ivor had had a special relationship with his car, an old wreck that he'd owned for about 15 years. It was a Toyota, but Henning wasn't sure of the model, only that it was red and rusty. However, it was easy to spot down one of the side streets. He opened the door and got in, but before he put the key in the ignition, he sat there and sniffed the air. It smelt mostly of cigarettes, but also a trace of something sweet. It smelled like Ivor. Suddenly it felt wrong to be sitting in his car. This was where Ivor had sat while searching for the same answers Henning was looking for now. Too many people had been hurt because of all this. Because of him. He turned the key and started the engine. It was still a few hours until 10 o'clock. He decided to go to a cafe for some breakfast. It was going to be a long day. Mary Darlin was a long, thin valley with lots of trees and forest, so the colours were beautiful on an autumn Monday. Henning had, on a few occasions, taken Nora and Jonas out there for a walk. He'd made sandwiches and juice in an attempt to continue a tradition that he'd experienced as a boy. Long walks in the country. Trina and him on the path, asking lots of questions. but Jonas was a child who quickly lost heart and felt imaginary pains in an arm or a leg, so it was seldom enjoyable. That, Henning thought, was the main reason they hadn't done it more often. If he was to be perfectly honest, however, he had to admit that all too often he'd used work as an excuse to leave Nora alone with Jonas at the weekend. Henning drove as far as he could into Mary Darlin on asphalt and stopped at the big open parking place by Scar. He stepped out into the autumn day. The clouds were wispy grey with the odd patch of white and were starting to gather ominously above the trees. Henning did up the zip on his jacket and looked at his watch. It was just before 10. There were 4 other cars in the car park, but Henning had no idea if one of them belonged to Andreas Kjær, so he started to walk. To begin with, he followed the wide cycle track that went up to the river, and soon the fast-flowing, burbling water appeared to his right. Henning had expected to meet someone running or on a bike, or perhaps see a tent on the shores of the lake, but he saw no one, and his only companion was the river. Henning looked from side to side, turned around, looking in every direction, and realized that he had walked almost the full 2.5 kilometers from Skar to Örjungen Lake without any sign of Kjær. The big lake opened out in front of him, with camping sites and shelters along the shore, and a dam to stop too much water flowing down towards the city. But no Andreas Kjær. Just when he felt it had all been a waste of time, he heard footsteps behind him. He spun round. The policeman looked different from when he'd last seen him, largely because it was now daylight. It had been dark in the entrance building on the Fossvien. Henning had gone to Andreas Kjær's home to ask him a few questions about the night of the fire, the night a report was made about Pulli sitting in a car outside Henning's home. But Kjær hadn't been home. So Henning had talked with Kjær's kids and learned that someone had recently killed their dog. Put it on the veranda for the kids to find. It was obvious to Henning then that pressure had been put on Andreas Kjær to stay quiet about something. And when Andreas Kjær had turned up, it was clear he wanted Henning to stop digging. The man who had thrown Henning up against the wall that evening and told him to stay away from him and his family now scoured the shore with eyes that looked as though they hadn't seen much sleep for a while.
"Should we go over there?"
Kjær asked, pointing to the dam.
"Why not?" Henning said.
Kjær was wearing running clothes, black trousers and a sky-blue jacket that rustled as he walked.
"Have you got your phone with you?" he asked.
"I left it in the car," Henning told him.
They walked down a gentle slope. The dam rose up a couple of meters to their left, perfect for anyone with a sense of adventure and balance to walk along. As they got closer to the sluices, the thunder of fast-moving water increased. They stopped in the middle of a wooden bridge,